This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, this is The Morning Run, and you're with me, Melissa Idris, as well as Sharad Kutan. 9.35 right now, and time for Pressing Matters, the show that takes you behind the headlines of the day. This week, we take a look at Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte's recent state visit to Malaysia. This was his first after he assumed presidency in June. Here's Bun Nagara, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, on the impact on intra-ASEAN diplomacy and geopolitical contestation in the region.
Good morning, Bun. I just want to begin with the question of how the media has framed the visit of Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte to Malaysia as a form of karaoke diplomacy. What do you make of news hooks like this?
Quite accurate, actually. Both media, both on the Malaysian as well as the Philippine side, it's a goodwill visit that also has important implications in ironing out some of the issues to improve cooperation, especially, you know, in areas of law and order, and basically to curb the kinds of crimes that we've seen in the southwestern Philippines, the Mindanao region, as well as the east coast of Sabah.
I think with the karaoke diplomacy was a focus on the level of sentiment between the two men. It was said that, you know, contrasting Duterte's often harsh tone that he's taken with, you know, President Obama, the USA, or Pope Francis from the Vatican, when he visited and he did that karaoke song session with the Prime Minister, it was seen as a kind of softer side of Duterte. Is this important to kind of focus on? Is the media sometimes misleading its public by making a story of this?
Not necessarily, because it's, in a way and to a degree, interesting as well. It's, I suppose, important to show that, you know, national leaders have more than one side to them. It's not just serious business all the time. And as long as, you know, this human side, shall we say, is kept within context and perspective, then, you know, without overdoing things, then I think, you know, that's all right, because, you know, it's not just a serious business, because, you know, national leaders, especially when they get together, such as in this case, you know, neighboring countries as well as fellow members of ASEAN, we have to show that, you know, there is a continuity, despite the change in government in the Philippines. There's a continuity in close relations, working together, and it takes various forms.
Now, because what we do know of Rodrigo Duterte is that he's said to be the first tri-nation president of the Philippines, meaning he has Christian, Muslim, and also a Lumad or indigenous kind of roots. He's got of all the three major communities of the Philippines, and he's also a politician from southern Philippines, where, of course, we share a border. And I wanted to ask you about that, especially in terms of the Sabah claim. As he was about to fly off to his visit to Bangkok and, of course, to us in Kuala Lumpur, he was asked about whether he was going to bring up the Sabah claim. It was said that he had mentioned it during his campaign. But he said, no, it's not on the agenda. He's got other things to focus on. Why does the Sabah claim persist as a question in bilateral relations between the two countries?
Well, technically, the Philippine government, that is the Philippine government of the Republic of the Philippines, has not given up the claim to Sabah. But if you go into the history and the legal aspects of it, the Republic of the Philippines has no basis for a claim. The claim as it exists or is alleged to exist comes only from the descendants of the former Sulu Sultanate, and not on the entire state of Sabah as we know it today, but only on the east coast section of Sabah, a part of today's Sabah, you know, which was known as British North Borneo. But going back into history, even then, I would argue that the Sulu Sultanate, as it existed centuries ago, did not have a claim to it, because it was originally supposed to have been granted to them by the Sultan of Brunei at that time, because that territory was part of the Brunei Sultanate. That grant did not happen, because that was on the agreement that it came in exchange for military support in a power struggle in Brunei at that time. That support did not come, until it was the power struggle was over. Anyway, it persists until today, because no sitting government in the Philippines, the Republic of the Philippines, can, I suppose, reasonably or realistically officially give up the claim, because then that president would be opposed by Congress at the time. Giving up the claim officially in the, on the part of the Philippines requires not just the action of the president of the Philippines, but also the full approval of its Congress.
So for the foreseeable future, this is unlikely to be off the books. Is not a real stumbling block to kind of doing things between our two countries, is it?
No, it's not. But at the same time, it acts as a kind of, you know, presumed basis for certain private groups in the Philippines to act on their own, to be an irritant and even a threat to the security of Sabah. So, you know, it's not perfect. It is definitely not the ideal situation. And but as far as government-to-government relations are concerned, it's not a real stumbling block.
But how does it impact the peace process? One of the things that Rodrigo Duterte spoke about, he says he will seek Malaysia's continued support for the peace process in southern Philippines. Where's that going? Why is that also a somewhat intractable problem?
Well, you know, for centuries, people in southwest Mindanao, which is so close to, you know, eastern portion of Sabah, they've had links, family links, personal links, and so on, that, you know, like any other border region between two countries, neighborhoods, families, and, you know, communities have grown up, despite the fact that there is a political border there. So, that is not a problem. The problem is really with the criminal gangs, kidnap for ransom, terrorist activities, piracy and so on that exist in that area. So really, what is required is close understanding between the two governments in such areas to work together. And this has happened in a very promising way, because with Duterte's recent visit, we find that, you know, both countries have agreed that in cases of, say, Malaysian security forces in hot pursuit of suspects and criminals, the Philippine government has agreed that you can cross over into Philippine territory without any problems, as long as, you know, the Malaysian side informs their Philippine counterparts that they are in hot pursuit of these suspects.
But this is also a question of the security architecture around Sabah. The ESCOM is called into question its efficacy. In fact, I think some Sabahan politicians saying, you know, dismantle ESCOM and just give us arms.
Well, the architecture is there in terms of institutions and practices, especially at official level. So it really boils down essentially to law and order issue. And as long as, you know, there is a good cooperation and understanding between the two governments, then it will help. In this case, Duterte's Philippines has agreed not only with Malaysia but also with Indonesia that, you know, the security forces of each of these countries will have the full permission of the Philippine government to enter into Philippine territory, you know, sea territory, whenever they are in hot pursuit. This has happened between the security forces of Malaysia and Thailand for many years already. So that has led to curbing of the insurgent activities in the Thai-Malaysia border area, and it has helped to the eventual elimination as well.
Speaking of the sea, the South China Sea issue and China's claims, Nine Dash Line and such, Duterte and even our own Prime Minister's apparent pivot towards China, do you see that as significant? Is it a softening towards China? What will happen to ASEAN's kind of collective position on the South China Sea claims?
It shouldn't affect ASEAN or any ASEAN country at all, because if you look at the larger picture, which I think we need to, it's very smart of President Duterte to improve relations with China, because the Philippines really needs China's help in curbing the drug trade. And, you know, this has been agreed by China. And it's not to actually diminish the Philippine relations with the United States or any other country. It's a value added to have, you know, better relations with countries that you need to improve relations with, especially on specific issues of, you know, monitoring, enforcement and law and order.
Hasn't there been some sort of chest thumping around what is called the West Philippine Sea? You know, questions, especially this discourse of a sovereignty. You know, once it's out there, it's very hard to compromise, right? Because if you have claimants both wanting one part of the sea, how do you move forward? What kind of compromises could be made?
You know, where there are overlapping claims, you know, obviously countries have to work them out. And this, in the South China Sea, this kind of issue has been persisting for, you know, decades, if not longer, and I suppose they will continue to persist, because I frankly do not see any immediate or early solution to that. So what's important is that we keep the disputed areas free of crime and all other problems such as terrorist activity. And, the claims can be settled at some future date. The way to go about it, the better way really is to cooperate in those areas which are non-problematic, what they call the low-hanging fruit, and then enlarge those areas of cooperation, increase cooperative actions and policies and measures, and in time, perhaps the problems such as the disputes over territory could become lesser by comparison.
What should the media be asking, especially in terms of intra-ASEAN diplomacy?
Really, agreements and declarations are fine in theory and in print when they are issued as statements. But the big question, I suppose, is what forms, first of all, what forms will they take on the ground? Secondly, how will they affect the lives of people living in those areas? And thirdly, what is the level of commitment and consistency that these measures will be adhered to? Because sometimes when there is a change of government, there are doubts about whether there will be continuity. So I think what has happened in this President Duterte's visit recently is promising.
That was Sharad Kutan speaking to Bun Nagara, Senior Fellow at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, better known as ISIS. Now, the Philippines is considered one of the world's most dangerous countries for journalists. So stay with us here on The Morning Run as we take a look at the violence that plagues the Philippines news media. After this, BFM 89.9. Good morning, you're listening to Pressing Matters as we take you behind the headlines with the people who bring you the news. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte has previously warned journalists in the Philippines that they are not exempted from assassination if they do wrong. Caught in the crossfire of his war against drugs are journalists who have received death threats for their reports on the issue. Here's BFM's Cheryl Koh, who spoke to Sean Crispin from the Committee to Protect Journalists about why the Philippines is considered one of the world's most dangerous countries for journalists. Sean is the Southeast Asia columnist at The Diplomat, based in Bangkok, where he has worked as a journalist and editor for over 16 years.
Well, our records show that since 1992, 77 journalists have been killed, where we've been able to confirm that the motive was related to their journalism. This statistic is a bit more conservative than some of the local groups in the Philippines. But, even with that more conservative figure, every year the CPJ puts out what we call an impunity index, which is a quantified measure of countries worldwide where journalists are killed and the killers go free. And the Philippines has consistently ranked fourth worldwide on that list. And what makes that particularly notable is that the three countries above the Philippines are and have generally been in a state of war with Somalia, Iraq, and Syria. So the Philippines ranks as the highest, if you will, peacetime country in the world for the most dangerous place to be a journalist. And so, that's a real black mark on the country's record, particularly as a practicing, functioning democracy.
And what were the top beats covered by all the victims?
Our research shows that in most cases, the journalists were covering some sort of corruption. And this is usually official corruption at a local provincial level. The second ranking source is covering organized crime. And obviously, the Philippines provincial areas are rife with crime. And this is something that, Duterte was elected on to try to fight. So our records show that about a quarter of those journalists killed since 1992 were covering some sort of criminal activity at the time of their death. This year, we haven't seen a significant uptick from our records. I believe two journalists have been killed, and we have not yet been able to confirm that that was certainly related to their journalism. There's actually, as far as killings go, there's been a bit of a downtick this year.
In June, Duterte was asked how he would solve the media killings, and he responded by saying that most journalists were killed because they were corrupted. Critics have spoken out against this sweeping statement. What are the CPJ's thoughts on it?
In the past decade, where I've covered press freedom violations across Southeast Asia, never have we recorded such outrageous and consistent comments from a national leader as Duterte has made in his first 100 days in office. Even before he was elected, he was making comments where he said that many of the journalists who were killed while on duty, that they deserved to be murdered. And he mentioned, one particular journalist, June Dalla, from the area where he served this governor. So it's been a very threatening tone that's been set from the get-go with this government. And, you know, I think the clear message is that they want journalists to self-censor themselves when they report on what is a very controversial and clearly rights-abusing war on drugs. And luckily, so far, you know, reporters in the Philippines are muscling through these threats, and they continue to critically expose and portray his murderous campaign. So far, so good. But the comments from the administration have been, you know, outrageous. And we've called on his government to roll back those comments, to apologize for them, and to instead, you know, work to protect the security of journalists that are covering his campaign rather than threaten them.
And you mentioned Hun Pala, and the thing is that he has been directly connected to Duterte, because after a member of the Davao Death Squad had told the Senate that Duterte had ordered the killing. So could you explain on that a little bit more?
We are asking Duterte to do the explaining. You know, there were extraordinary revelations made in the Senate hearing you mentioned about his past 10 years governor in Davao, with various allegations pinned to him directly of masterminding and orchestrating assassinations, you know, including of Hun Pala. And so we're asking for the president to offer an official explanation for that testimony. But it's clear, you know, that the tone was set, and he had mentioned this journalist by name, you know, before this testimony was made public. So this is a question that Duterte needs to answer, and soon.
Another example is that two Manila-based journalists have been targets for social media attacks, and they've received rape threats and harm on them and their families. What has the Philippines government done to address these threats?
Nothing to date. And this is something, too, that we've called on the government to address, to identify the culprits and to, you know, prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law for making threats against journalists. You know, the social media sphere is emerging as a very dangerous place for journalists, where up till recently, you most certainly had, you know, criticism from readers in forums attached to stories. But that's taken a completely different, violent and threatening tone since Duterte came to office. And something that, you know, we are researching is whether or not, you know, some of these seemingly pro-government supporters are actually, you know, on the government's payroll. You know, is there institutionalized trolling being done by the government to threaten journalists and making it seem as though, you know, these are anonymous threats when effectively they may be state linked? So this is something that, you know, we have not been able to confirm, but we have our suspicions that the communications department attached to the president's office may have a role in some of this trolling. And it's something that we're investigating. But until then, the government, one, you know, needs to ensure that journalists are safe, particularly those journalists that are now covering the drug war. And one meaningful step in that direction would be identifying these anonymous people over social media that are making these threatening statements to journalists and prosecuting them to the fullest extent of the law to send a signal across the board that, yes, criticism is welcome, but death threats and rape threats, you know, will not be tolerated over social media. This is something that is happening across the region, you know, in Thailand, in Malaysia, in Vietnam as well. We've found in the past, you know, government links to this sort of trolling, and we've obviously advocated and campaigned against it. We're just particularly worried about the tone of these threats in the Philippines, and it looks like they're accelerating and have accelerated since Duterte has come to power and the war on drugs campaign has commenced. It's a very worrying trend. And so the Philippines, it seems to be, you know, the most threatening sphere in the region at present. So it's something that we're concentrating on.
How do journalists in the Philippines navigate through these threats that they receive on social media while still doing what they need to do, which is report on what needs to be reported?
Some of the reporters I've spoken to have effectively, they ignore these threats and go about their business. I've spoken with some photographers, one in particular based in Manila, who is on the night beat, you know, and this is when a lot of the apparent extrajudicial killings are happening in the Philippines. They said to me they've somewhat changed their modus operandi, and that when they go out on the street beat, they make sure that they travel in groups. I think in the past, they were perhaps, you know, overtly attached to police officials, you know, knowing a bust was coming. You know, this predates Duterte, so that, you know, they could be there when the bust happened and get their photographs. Now they're shying from that sort of activity, in that, you know, they don't want to be seen as accomplices in, you know, what has often turns out to be a murderous situation. So they've insulated and they've taken, you know, 2-3 steps back from the police. And that means that sometimes, you know, they're late on the scene, later than they were perhaps previously, but they feel they need to do that so that, you know, they are definitely, you know, observers and not perceived to be participants in these anti-drug raids that oftentimes are resulting in unexplained deaths. So I've found that some of the journalists are changing the mode and how they work, particularly in covering the crime beat. These are probably wise tactics, you know, considering what's happening in the Philippines.
What is the CPJ most concerned about when it comes to journalists reporting on the war on drugs in the Philippines?
We are, you know, highly concerned that although we have not seen, you know, any direct violence targeting journalists who are covering the drug war, that, you know, as these threats develop on social media, that that may change, and that we're very concerned that journalists may soon find themselves, you know, in the line of fire while they cover some of these extrajudicial killings related to the drug war. The expose has given the Duterte regime a bloody nose in the international community. And it would seem, you know, that as international criticism mounts, you know, from places like the EU, the United States and the UN, that they're going to want to suppress coverage of this campaign as it continues. And that's, you know, obviously going to put journalists potentially at threat. Now, we're monitoring this very closely, and we've not yet recorded any instances, you know, where journalists, you know, have been fired at, have been directly threatened by security officials. We have one, maybe two instances where that's happened, but it's not yet a mounting trend. We're concerned it could be. And so that's why we're calling on the Duterte administration to dial down the rhetoric and to serve its role of protecting journalists, not threatening them. And, you know, one meaningful step in that direction would be for top officials in the administration to stop insinuating that journalists are somehow implicated in the drug trade, and for Duterte to make good on his promise to set up, you know, a new super body to investigate past journalist murders and bring their perpetrators to justice. You know, and that would include the Yun Pala case, where apparently it seems the president himself could be implicated. So that's our call, and those are our concerns. And we'll be monitoring the situation closely heretofore.
That was Cheryl Koh speaking to Sean Crispin from the Committee to Protect Journalists. And earlier in the show, Sharad Kutan spoke to Bun Nagara from the Institute of Strategic and International Studies. Thanks for listening to Pressing Matters. We've got the news bulletin coming up at 10 o'clock, so stay right here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.